Good evening, everyone. My name's Tim Besley. I'm the director of STICR, the professor of economics at the LSE, and I'm speaking as the chair of this session in my capacity as co-director of the UBS LSE pensions program. And I'm delighted to say that this has been an extremely successful collaboration between the corporate sector and the LSE. It's been going a little over 3 years now. And we sponsor a number of events, a number of research projects, and in particular, a very successful set of lectures, of which this is a continuation. The lecturer this evening on the topic of reforming public pensions in the US and UK is Peter Diamond, and I really can't think of anyone better or more authoritative on this topic. Peter is an institute professor and professor of economics at MIT, and he's been there a long time, since 1966. His career began, I think, more in public finance, has moved into the areas of social insurance and behavioral economics latterly. And of course, he's well known also for his work on search theory and in macroeconomics. He's been past president of the American Economics Association, of the Econometric Society, and the National Academy of Social Insurance. He's a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and a member of the National Academy of Sciences. For those of us who've studied public finance, Peter is an iconic figure, having written some of the seminal contributions, particularly with Jim Merlies, the Diamond and Merlies work all of us studied in great detail in graduate school. His earlier work on Social Security in some ways, I think, defined the field as a mainstream field within economics. Latterly, he spent a great deal of time in commentary on policy issues and issues of real substance. And this evening, I think he's going to tell us about issues that are not only based in the best academic thinking, but also are deeply relevant for the policy challenges going forward. So Peter, welcome to the LSE, and thank you very much for agreeing to our invitation.
Tim, thank you for that kind invitation. I have done a fair bit of public economics research while visiting in England, whatever university Jim Merlies happened to be at the time is a place where I've spent considerable time. Today, I will describe the current debate about Social Security in the American sense, meaning just pensions, not other social insurance elements. And I'll give you a brief description of the program along the way, because obviously I shouldn't presume you know anything about it. And in particular, I will do some economic analysis, commenting on the quality of the different proposed reform fixes. Any relevance of these comments for issues in dispute here is not totally accidental. I did read the Pension Commission's report as part of preparing this. In the U.S., every year, the Office of the Chief Actuary of Social Security prepares a 75-year projection of the finances of Social Security. And that plays a key role in the debate. Is there a problem? How big a problem? Those numbers are taken as defining things. And in addition, reform proposals that are serious proposals get a report from the Office of the Actuary to either confirm or not confirm that they are reforms that will solve the financial problem. There is, and I won't go into it, an interesting turf war developing as the Congressional Budget Office has also gotten into the business of doing projections. The Office of the Actuary has done 75-year projections for decades. CBO felt it had to do 100 years, as if that extra 25 told us anything. But so far, the Office of the Actuary is holding on to things. So the last projection, the one that came out in late March 2005, is this one. The vertical axis is measured as percentages of taxable payroll. Taxable payroll, just to put it in context, is about 40% of GDP. So you can think of it in either way. This line here, the red and then blue, that's close to horizontal, labeled income. The bulk of the income for the system is the 12.4% payroll tax rate. In addition, a fraction of the benefits paid are subject to the income tax, and a fraction of those revenues go automatically to Social Security. And that's why that line is not perfectly horizontal. As benefits rise, so too does the income revenue from that. The curve, which is first solid blue and then dotted blue, is what it would cost to pay the benefits as defined by law, referred to in the debate as scheduled benefits. As you can see right now, Social Security is running a sizable annual cash flow surplus with the payroll tax revenue considerably exceeding cost of benefits, this trivial administrative costs as well that are covered out of this budget. By law, Social Security has no ability to borrow, no ability to demand general revenues. So when the trust fund hits zero, benefits have to be cut back to the point that they can be paid for by the cash flow. Hence, we have the solid blue line, which is what expenditures would be under current law. And as you can see, the trust fund hits zero in 2041, not exactly imminent. And at that point, the 74% of existing benefits can be paid. So that's the financial picture. Social Security was last reformed in 1983. Knowing, of course, that the baby boomers would be coming along, there was a conscious plan to build up a large trust fund that would then be run down as the baby boomers retired. The 1983 plan was designed to cover expenses for 75 years. If this projection is right, it will have done it for almost 60, which isn't bad. But the picture has looked like this for a long time, because as you see out at the end of the horizon, as people keep living longer and longer, and as the cohorts are not as large relatively as the baby boomers, the expenditures are considerably higher than the revenues, and that's been true for quite a while. That is, the 75th year has been an unbalanced year. So each year when you do a new 75-year projection, you have 1 year realized. You add a year on the end. The year on the end is a year in deficit. So we had a picture looking like this very shortly after 1983, but with a even more distant drop-off. This picture includes using the trust fund. The current trust fund's about $1.7 trillion. Just in terms of what it would take to fix the system, with a 75-year horizon, it would be $4 trillion. That would be 1.8% of taxable payroll over the 75 years. If you want to end with the traditional precautionary balance in the trust fund, that takes it up to 1.9% of payroll. So it's a noticeable problem, 1.9% of payroll. You multiply that by 0.4, it's a significant fraction of GDP. But there's no way it's an out-of-sight element, especially if you recognize that U.S. payroll tax rate is very low by international standards, by continental European standards, let us say. There is a major debate in the U.S., a debate that I believe cannot be answered by econometric methods, over the effect on national savings of having built up this trust fund of $1.7 trillion. And I want to briefly describe that to you because I think it's also highly relevant for considering certain policies here. The first thing to notice is of course, the U.S. had deficits almost every year from 1983 through today. The exceptions were a few years under President Clinton. And so in a literal sense, the surpluses in Social Security were financing the deficits in the rest of the budget. That is, the trust fund holds nothing but Treasury bonds with interest rates indexed to long-term Treasury bond interest rates. So in a mechanical sense, all that money was going to finance the deficit. But that's not the relevant sense for this debate. The relevant sense for this debate is the counterfactual. If in 1983 the legislation had not included a higher payroll tax rate than needed, what would have happened to national savings? And there are two extreme views. I don't know that anyone holds either of them exactly, but let me give them because I think it makes the issue fairly simply. The critical debate is on the effect of the surplus on the behavior of the government, the rest of the government's budget. There's not a whole lot of debate about private responses. That's not an issue. It's widely recognized if you put up the payroll tax, you're going to cut back on consumption to a very large fraction of that. And the fact that somewhere way down the road you would have to have a higher payroll tax to pay for benefits that would otherwise be paid for out of interest and principal is not viewed as terribly important. So the debate is about the behavior of the government. And one view of that, the view I subscribe to, is that the presence of the Social Security surplus has had very little impact on the rest of the budget. That is, starting with the policies of President Reagan that were implemented before the 1983 reform, the U.S. had very large deficits. There was a wide consensus in Congress that the deficits were too large. But of course, Congress doesn't legislate deficits. What Congress legislates are tax increases and spending cuts. And no politician likes to vote for either of them. So there's a political pain threshold of how far they would go. And the U.S. in the 80s went through a series of gyrations of trying to put in place a political process that would get those deficits addressed. What the newspapers report is what we call the unified deficit. That is, there's the on-budget deficit and the off-budget deficit, and officially Social Security is off-budget. But what the politicians talk about when you have a deficit is the smallest deficit you can talk about, for obvious reasons. And that was the unified deficit. A few newspapers would report both deficits in the story, but most of them reported the unified deficit and nothing else. But I don't think that had much of an effect, because I think what drove the process of slowly getting rid of the deficit was how difficult it was to raise taxes and cut spending. Taxes were raised under President Bush, first President Bush, which many think is what cost him his reelection. Taxes were raised again under President Clinton with no Republican support. And so that was a difficult process. Spending growth was slowed down in part by rules that were put in place in the Senate that made it hard to raise spending. I don't think the fact that the unified deficit was merely too large and not even larger played any particular role in this. When President Bush went for the first round of tax cuts, he said, we can do these without touching the Social Security surplus, which suggests the Social Security surplus was irrelevant then. And then he turned around and said, let's have another tax cut, and this time it will touch the Social Security surplus. I don't think it had much effect then. The counter view, and I'll give an extreme version, is that Congress has a target unified deficit. And therefore, any dollar of Social Security surplus generates a matching dollar of deficit on the rest of the budget. And therefore, apart from some spending on public investment, you would get no contribution to national savings. That's the line that has been pushed, particularly by the right in this. The line that it led to saving has been pushed by the left. And those two views are related to what I will get to, which is voluntary accounts. So that's the debate. People have run some time series regressions. They're not terribly robust. It's hard to believe when all you've got is 20 years of data, and when you've got a complex budgetary process, that a simple time series regression is going to produce anything you're going to believe. So let me now turn to describing the system very quickly. It's called Old Age Survivors and Disability Insurance because it has all three pieces. I'm not going to talk about the disability program, and I'm not going to talk about the program for children who lose a working parent. I'm going to focus on the retirement program, and that includes benefits for elderly survivors who are, of course, primarily widows. As I said before, the tax rate is 12.4%. The earnings that are subject to tax go up currently to $90,000. That is indexed to average earnings. The tax is half employer, half employee. And just to put the $90,000 in the U.S. context, each year roughly 6% of workers have earnings above the $90,000 level. In 1977 is when the level was actually set, but 10% of earnings were above the cap. That is, the 6% of earners had $90,000 plus enough more to make up 10% of earnings. With growing inequality of earnings in the U.S., that's up to 15%. Next, let me talk about benefits. It is a complex process that is trying to address both of the issues that pension plans are about, the issue of trying to deal with poverty with less reliance on means-tested programs, and also worrying about replacement rates for a wide swath of the public and not just an anti-poverty program. And indeed, that is a major issue. My belief is it's a job of government to address both of those issues, both poverty and replacement rates. And as you know, the Blair government has been switching the available revenues to more focus on poverty. In the U.S. context, Social Security is so popular that it's potentially a vehicle for more revenues so you can address both issues. If that were the case here, I would think there's too little attention being placed to replacement rates and a little rebalance. So here's how it works. Each individual has an earnings history. Their earnings history is recorded in nominal terms as you go along, and then they're indexed up by that same average earnings index that's used on the tax cap. And then they pick out your best 35. That's called the average indexed monthly earnings, because I keep forgetting they divide by 12. And then that's fed into a progressive benefit formula. I'll show you that in a couple of minutes, leading to the primary insurance amount. You get that as a benefit if you retire at the age for full benefits, which is also called the normal retirement age. If you retire, start benefits before that, you get a reduced benefit. If you start benefits after that, you get a larger benefit. No benefits can be claimed before age 62. Between 62 and the age for full benefits, which is in process of moving slowly from 65 to 67, that change was legislated in 1983. Between those ages, you have to stop work or effectively stop work to collect benefits. There's an allowable earnings level, and that's it. Beyond the age for full benefits, you can start benefits and continue working if you want. And if you delay benefits behind age 70, there are no further increases. So, of course, nobody does. Here's the picture of the benefit level for different ages at the start of benefits, drawn for what will happen, and we don't reach this till 2022, if the age for full benefits were 67. So you see it's 100% at 67. 3 years earlier, which is what used to be the gap between 65 and 62, It's 80% of that level. They didn't change the age 62 eligibility to claim benefits. At that point, it's 70%. Up beyond 65, you get 8% a year. Analysis of what happens around age 62, analysis at many ages, but age 62 is the most important because age 62 has the largest hazard rate of people stopping work and claiming benefits, or at least claiming benefits. A number of them have stopped work earlier, but it's also the modal point for stopping. At age 62, this structure is approximately actuarially fair. That is, what you lose by giving up a year's benefit if you wait till 63 is matched over the average lifetime in increased benefits from then on. So there's neither an incentive to go on working beyond it nor a disincentive, which means that if we were to jump age 62 up to age 63 and didn't change anything else, we would not be helping the finances of the system. So increasing the earliest age for claiming benefits in a system that's actuarially fair doesn't do anything for the finances of the system. If you want to think about what to do at that age, then the issue is you're going to force some people to work to 63 because they'd like to stop at 62, but they're liquidity constrained. For some people you do that to, you've done them harm. It would have been a good plan for them to have retired at 62. This is particularly people who have poor jobs or no jobs, people in poor health, people without private pensions. For other people, you're helping them. They're claiming benefits as soon as they can get them, and they're making a mistake, and it shows up in poverty at advanced ages, particularly poverty for their widows. The balance between those two is the issue of whether 62 is a good age. We don't have any good evidence on whether 62 is right or not. I don't know how to change it, and I particularly don't know any simple formulas relating it to life expectancy or healthy life expectancy in a way you would say that's a formula that makes a lot of sense, because most of the discussions about changing it refer to averages over the whole population. But for a lot of the population, this is irrelevant. They retire beforehand and claim benefits, and then they get them, or they were going to go on working beyond this point anyway. And it's really these two minorities, the ones who were hurt by the forced delay, the ones who hurt themselves by retiring too soon, that you have to focus on. No reason to think that's simply connected. Now, another element of this is to look at the incentive to delay getting benefits. You take the percentage increase in benefits for waiting a year. That's what that looks like. And I think it's very clear that pattern makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. When you have a constant fraction, then of course you have a declining percentage increase. We see that beyond the age for full benefits. That 8% a year is a smaller and smaller percentage of the accumulated benefit. It makes absolutely no sense. I think it captures the commonplace behavior of legislatures to do things in additive terms. Multiplication, I guess, seems too hard. We need improved math in the elementary schools, and maybe someday that would go away. As you all know, mortality rates rise steadily with age. So if you were trying to stay actuarially fair, these percentage increases should be rising sharply. And indeed, in the U.S., once you get up to the ages beyond the age for full benefits, there is a large tax on further delays in benefits. Just to put it in context, here is what happens with a basic state pension. Here, you're allowed to delay the start of benefits by up to 5 years. That may have been extended beyond five, and the percentage increase was increased to 10.4 in very recent legislation. But as you see, it suffers from the same lack of making any sense, that the percentage increase in what you get declines steadily the more years you wait. So that's one element that ought to be changed. How could you address this? Well, the obvious thing to do is what they do in Sweden, which is they have automatic adjustments of the way your benefits change with the age at which you start based on an actuarial calculation. The government dictates the kind of calculation to be done. The actuary collects the mortality statistics, the relevant interest rate, and adjusts them. In Sweden, they also do that for the benefits at the earliest age you can claim benefits, so the system is fully indexed for life expectancy. You don't have to buy into both of those pieces. It would make a lot of sense to be actuarially fair for delays. I personally think it doesn't make sense to put the full cost of longer life expectancies at retirement on decreased benefits. Peter Orszag, an economist at Brookings, and I have put forth a plan for the U.S., and what we have done is automatic indexing for life expectancy, with half of it coming out of decreased benefits, half of it coming out of automatic increases in the payroll tax rate. And the underlying logic is if you're expecting to live longer, that's obviously going to change your lifetime budget constraint. If you don't think work is going to increase proportionally, and I don't because I think we've seen an awful lot of evidence of a long time of rising life expectancy and falling age of retirement. Age of retirement in the U.S. as in the U.K. has stabilized, but no sign of it turning around. A lot of that is income effects. I see no reason to think it will change in the future and be proportional. If it's not proportional, a rational thing to do is to reduce consumption both before and after retirement. Before corresponds to an increase in the payroll tax rate. After corresponds to a reduction of benefits. Why half and half? Nice round numbers. I won't claim anything more than that. Here's the benefit formula. It's a three-piece linear formula, very steep at the bottom. You can think of that as a single system approximation to the two system you've got here with a basic pension, which is the same for everybody with a full career. And then SERPs was linear on top of that. S2P is not linear. It's more progressive than that. Roughly 15% of workers have lifetime earnings so that they end up in the top bracket. So the bulk of the labor force is in that 32% element. In order to put that into a more useful term, let me give you some numbers on replacement rates. Replacement rates are very tricky because there are so many different ways of doing it. So let me tell you how the Office of the Actuary calculated it for the numbers I will present. First of all, they studied the life cycle pattern of earnings. All the examples will have the average life cycle pattern, so much lower earnings when younger, rapid rises through the 30s. Hitting a peak relative to average wages around age 50, declining relative to average wages after that. Secondly, I will only consider a worker who has had a full career. That means at least 35 years in our system. I will measure the replacement rate relative to lifetime earnings, not earnings at the end of the career. That will bring it down. And here are some numbers. The 30,000 number, 44% replacement rate, that's somebody that's very close to the middle of the distribution of lifetime earnings. But that's the entire distribution. That's not the distribution of people with full careers. That's a considerably higher number. As you can see, this captures the principle that the need for replacement is higher for low earners than high earners. This also is for a single worker retiring at the age for full benefits. As I said before, most workers retire at 62. So multiply these numbers by 80% to get what actually happens to more of the workers. But we also have a benefit for spouses who never worked, and it's a top-up benefit for spouses with low earnings. It's 50% of the retirement benefit. So after you've multiplied these by 0.8, you can multiply them by 1.5 for a single earner couple. A two-earner couple with the same earnings The system is gender neutral, so there's no husband-wife distinctions. Would get these numbers, and for somebody between those two, you would get a top up to the benefit that would come. Just very briefly, the U.S. also has a guaranteed minimum income for the elderly, but it is below the U.S. poverty line, which is itself very low. So you see there's still a fair bit of poverty among the elderly. The thing to take away from this is poverty rates are pretty low for married couples, much higher for non-married, and of course, overwhelmingly, the non-married are widows. That is an issue. The other thing is, as is the case here, the elderly rely very heavily on Social Security. A stunning third of the elderly are getting at least 90% of their income from Social Security. Needless to say, this makes it politically a very hot topic. Now, why do we need to worry about replacement rates throughout the income distribution? This cartoon from The New Yorker, I think, captures it. The hard-to-read caption is, "Winning the lottery is crucial to my retirement plans." And there's a great deal of evidence that people do not do a good job in preparing for retirement. And indeed, the New York Times sent a reporter one time out to lottery ticket sales outlets and interviewed people. And indeed, there are people who think of buying lottery tickets as a form of investment. The other thing that's happening in the U.S. that's also happening here is a large swing from defined benefit to defined contribution systems. We have had a pension benefit guarantee corporation since 1974. It is now in a deep hole. You probably noticed United Airlines has just handed its pension plan over to the federal government, and there are a bunch more firms that will follow. Some people are very upset at this picture, at the move from defined benefit to defined contribution. I am not among them. I've always thought it was not possible to adequately regulate defined benefit plans to keep them fully funded because you get fluctuations in the values of the assets at precisely the times they go down, at precisely the times firms have liquidity problems and have trouble making them up. And you don't want the pensions to not be insured because then the workers could end up in a deep hole and they have no ability to monitor whether the firm's doing a good job. With defined contribution systems, at least everybody knows what the rule is. So that's the end of the background, and I've used up most of my time, but I'll push ahead anyway. In the 2000 campaign, Mr. Bush said he wanted voluntary individual accounts, he didn't want any revenue increases, and if elected, he would appoint a commission to come up with plans to do that. Shortly after the election, he did appoint a commission. They reported in December of 2001. After September 11, 2001, Social Security was on a back burner. The White House has never said anything about that report other than thank you. In the 2004 campaign, the president ran on the same principles he had run the time before, with, again, no more details coming out of the White House. Since then, the story has changed. The president put, I will say, much to my surprise, Social Security reform as his number one domestic policy reform. And here is a quote from the State of the Union address. And as you can see, what we, our vocabulary in the U.S. talks about individual accounts in two forms. One of them is called carve-out accounts, which is what the president favors, which is using existing payroll tax revenue, which currently is used to finance the approximately pay-as-you-go system that we have for the individual accounts. The alternative to levy a new payroll tax are called add-on accounts. This is, of course, the carve-out accounts is our version of your contracting out. So let me say a few words about how it was designed. The president took the structure from the commission. The commission, in turn, took it from a GAO report, government congressional research unit, from earlier on. And basically, the money that you divert into an individual account is treated as a loan. You are charged interest on the loan, and the president has called for 3% above the inflation rate. Why that number? Because that is the projection of what the Social Security Trust Fund would earn holding government bonds with the same money. When you retire, they calculate your debt, they calculate your life expectancy, again by cohort, not broken down in any other way, and they reduce your monthly benefits by enough, if you have average life expectancy, to repay principal and interest on the loan. Given this structure, the commission actually wanted to subsidize these by charging an interest rate below the Treasury rate. They got a lot of flack for that. They couldn't come up with any good arguments for why you should subsidize people doing individual accounts. I presume that's why the president has dropped it. So what do the accounts do? What the account does effectively is let you sell government bonds to buy stocks and corporate bonds. And if you have a diversified portfolio outside Social Security and in the tax-favored retirement accounts we have, the opportunity to do that again is worth essentially nothing, because you already have the opportunity to do that. And if you've chosen your bond-stock ratio sensibly, there's no reason to change it when you're given another opportunity to do it on the same terms that you're already doing it. If you're in a corner and you have no stock, and that's about half of the American labor force, and that's mostly because, apart from some small precautionary balances and housing, they have no assets, there are no financial assets, very hard to buy stock. So it gives people the option of taking on higher risk and a higher expected return. Needless to say, it's not packaged in that term. The advocates of it say there's a diversity of risk aversion, so this gives people the opportunity to choose a portfolio that fits their risk aversion. The counterargument looks at the evidence coming from worker behavior in our existing individual accounts, particularly ones set up by corporations, the 401ks. The Pensions Commission has noted this research, which says very large fractions of American workers make an absolute mess of it. What I like about this structure is it makes it very clear what's at issue. I think the contracting out rules here, when it's a subsidy, when it's a tax, when you're ahead of the game, when you're behind, lack that kind of clarity. And in addition, there have been times when I gather when it was a deliberate subsidy. I see no reason for that. So from the other element at the end, the president has said, you must annuitize enough of the account that combined with whatever remains of your traditional benefit, you're above the official poverty line. And that means you won't collect means-tested benefits, which are actually below the poverty line. Beyond that, you can take all the rest as a lump sum. A lot of economists, and I'm one of them, think people do not understand the value of annuities, don't understand the payoff, which is very clear in the simulations. From monthly benefits that are inflation adjusted and last as long as you live, and that therefore the push from the politicians that this is money you'll be able to leave to your heirs, which is suggested as that bonus you get on top of your benefits, but of course money can only be used once, it's one or the other. We think that's a mistake. Why is this favored by some people? And the answer is, it's a way to contribute to national savings. Well, if these accounts were financed by tax increases or spending cuts, that would contribute to national savings. If they are financed by borrowing, that does not directly contribute to national savings. And while there have been some on the far right who have called for drastic cuts in government spending to finance this, nobody thinks that's going to happen. So everyone talks of these as debt-financed accounts that will do nothing for national savings, but somehow magically their existence will bring around a change in behavior. And the argument behind that, and this you'll see is a repeat of the argument of what did the trust fund do, is that the individual accounts will greatly increase the reported deficit because under Congressional Budget Office rules, giving money into an individual account for the individuals to buy a stock is an expenditure. So the deficit will go up. And if you think there's a target in the unified deficit, lo and behold, something will happen on the other side and savings will go up. There are two problems with that. One argument I already made, I don't believe that politics. The other argument is I don't think the accounting would be done that way. Congress from time to time does directed scorekeeping. It tells the Congressional Budget Office how to score something. And already the head of the Senate Budget Committee has said these should be scored on a net basis. That is, the expenditure minus the gain from the reduced future benefits. And of course, if you're pricing them, charging interest at the government rate, that's a zero. And I also want to point out that Hungary, Poland, and Sweden, all of them have individual accounts. And for official deficit reporting purposes, the money going into the individual accounts is reported as government revenue and helps them meet their deficit targets. So if this happens, there is no pressure and no need to respond. The other thing that's interesting and I think has some relevance for here is the issue of how to organize the accounts. Let me say a little bit about that. Let me do background. Obviously, all of this discussion starts with Chile. In Chile, there are a very tightly regulated, specialized mutual funds. A worker puts all of his money with one of them. Up until very recently, each mutual fund company had a single fund, and the incentives were such that they all had almost identical portfolios. Now there are five funds for each of them, and they're matched because there are rate of return guarantees, not in terms of an absolute level, but relative to others. Your fund can't do too badly. The Chilean accounts have had a lot of advertising expense. I'm told the way it works is there are a lot of attractive young women in short skirts trying to get workers to switch from one mutual fund company to another mutual fund company. The costs were much higher to begin with. They're now down around 13-14% of deposits. By law, they charge a front load, and they're not allowed to charge a maintenance, a management fee, or an exit fee. So that's one example that's out there. Totally private, individual chooses the mutual fund, deals with the mutual fund, and it's proved moderately expensive, but also, I think, a lot cheaper than elsewhere, including some unnamed country I happen to be standing in. The second example that gets a lot of attention is Sweden. Sweden recently set up individual accounts. They wanted individuals to have access to a wide variety of choice. There are over 600 different mutual funds for the Swedes to choose among. But the individuals do not deal directly with the mutual funds. They deal with a government agency. The government agency accumulates the new deposits or the transfers between different funds and deals directly with the mutual fund. It is thought that one of the ways of saving money relative to the Chilean model is not let the mutual funds know who their customers are. It makes it much harder to advertise, except obviously at the beginning when everyone was choosing. There was a very heavy, very expensive advertising campaign. Since then, the advertising has mostly dried up. There's not an awful lot of movement of people changing their portfolios. The new flow of new workers is mostly young, you know how much the young think about their pensions. So it's not surprising that 95% of new workers in the system make no choice whatsoever and end up in the government-designed default. But being Swedes, it's an excellently designed default, and in fact, I know academic economists who chose the default fund as better than anything out there. A second element is that you can only be an approved company if you agree to to the pricing rules set down by the government. So there's price controls on these. And currently, the average is about 75 basis points, which is, again, lower even than your stakeholder pensions. The thing to keep in mind, for those of you not familiar, if you have a 40-year career and you're putting a percentage of payroll in, your typical deposit, your kroner, is in there for roughly 20 years on average. So how much you've lost as a result of these annual fees on balances by the time you retire is about 20 times the annual charge. So at 75 basis points, that's about 15%, slightly larger than Chile. In contrast to both of these models, the proposal in the U.S. is based on the system that was set up, the defined contribution system set up for federal civil servants. It is proposed that there will only be a small number of funds, something on the order of 7. They will all be widely diversified. The Swedes didn't have that, and a lot of Swedes went heavily into IT funds, which was not a very good idea, given when they launched their system. And these funds would be managed by private firms, but they wouldn't know who the customers were, and there would be competitive bidding on a recurring basis for who does that. Barclays handles the S&P 500 fund. The charges are almost non-existent, something on the order of 1 or 2 basis points. It really is trivial because they don't have any of the overhead costs you have dealing with people directly. They don't answer phone calls. They don't mail out statements. It was deal with these large sums. It seems to me that's if you're going to go this way, that's an excellent way to go. The government here should think about opening itself up in competition with the private market, instead of this being an example of government-private cooperation. This could be an example of government-private competition, and see what happened. The accounts have the following difficulty. There's the cash flow associated with the president's accounts. Those loans are paid back eventually, but you see there's about 40 years of a negative cash flow. If those accounts were the only thing that happened, the trust fund measured relative to taxable payroll here, instead of hitting zero in 2041, hit zero in 2029. At that point, there's severe political risk. Let me just run very quickly through the primary ideas for cutting benefits that have been put on the table. One of them is called price indexing. It's not price indexing in the sense that only a price index is used. You go on using a wage index the way I described it to you, and then you just cut benefits by the percentage real wage growth. When that was first floated by the commission, people, gee, price indexing is a good thing. There's not enough indexing in the economy. That sounds small, but as you can see from these numbers, they're not. And of course, you have experience with how large the cuts become in time if you start price indexing benefits here. First of all, it's an arbitrary cut. When you're doing indexing, what you'd like to do is do indexing to keep the revenues and the expenditures in line, as in the way I described indexing for life expectancy. This doesn't do that. If you have more real wage growth, you have bigger benefit cuts, but you have less need for the money. So it doesn't make any sense. And if you think that replacement rates adjusted for affordability is the way to think about the system, price indexing plays no role whatsoever. The other thing that's talked about in the U.S. is increasing the normal retirement age. I have here an example of increasing it from 67 to 70. As you can see, for any given age at which you retire, you get a benefit cut because that chart of how your benefit varies by the distance from the age for full benefits just shifts around. And as you can see, the largest benefit cut happens for 62-year-olds. What do we know about 62-year-old retirees in the U.S.? We know two things. they have lower average lifetime earnings than people retiring at any other age. They have shorter life expectancy than people retiring at any other age. So let's give them the biggest benefit cuts. Somehow, I think it's an unattractive plan. Here, if you raise the state pension age, you're doing the two things that we have separate in the U.S. You're increasing the age at which people can first claim benefits, and by taking away that 10.4% benefit increase, because you're measuring it from 1 year later, you're also cutting benefits. You're doing those two things. Those two things are separable. You can think about them separately. You can think about the benefit cuts, and you can think about changing the age, and I think they come in differently. There are the benefit cuts from a 1 year increase in the state pension age. It's the same slide I showed you earlier, except now it's labeled age instead of years of delay. And does it make sense to have the largest benefit cuts for the people claiming, who would be claiming at 66 otherwise? Well, not very many people delay here anyway, but I don't think it makes sense. I think it would make sense to have much more serious incentives for continued work and then to do the benefit cuts that make sense. And in terms of who gets cut off from benefits, I think it makes sense to think hard about who is actually affected and how to balance the gainers and the losers. I haven't seen anything in the literature here. Let me recap the highlights, and then we can have a bit of time for questions. The role of government in the provision of retirement pensions, I believe, needs to address both poverty among the elderly and inadequate replacement rates. And I think there should be enough money raised to address both of those sensibly. Secondly, I think the replacement rate is the central concept for thinking about how your system is working. There's nothing magic that there is some number you're shooting for. You adjust that for affordability. Using a price index rather than a wage index is just arbitrary cuts in replacement rates from that perspective. There are methods of holding down the costs of funded individual accounts here that do not seem to have made it on the political agenda. Having pre-funding of pensions is useful, I think, primarily or maybe only if it's a device that contributes to increased national savings. If you have contracting out and that's financed by borrowing, you don't have increased national savings. I see no particular gain in substituting private contracted out pensions for public pensions, publicly provided pensions. In the U.S., we take reforming Social Security very seriously. I know you do here as well. This cartoon, again, from The New Yorker is my wrap-up. The man on the desert island is saying to the helicopter, "Forget about me, save Social Security." Now I'd be happy to take questions, comments. Yes.
Can we get this so that everyone can hear? Let's wait for the mic.
Oh, let me just say there is a written version of this talk, and as you've probably guessed, it's considerably longer than even what I attempted to present, much less what I actually did present. It will be up on my website now at my MIT webpage, and any of you who would like to see a copy, it's available.
Yeah, just as I've never understood why property taxes here, council taxes, are capped at an absolute level that's at best upper middle class. I mean, I think the most right-wing politician in Texas wouldn't dare propose such a property tax system, which is below proportionate. As far as my calculations go, from what you said, there needs to be roughly a 15% increase proportionately in the Social Security contribution rate. Plus, suppose we kept F prime constant at 15% after the $90,000, and we taxed the earned income above $90,000 at the current 12.5% rate. That would solve the problem, right? That would raise 22.5%. or yes. 18%. That would be it.
The thing to keep in mind, two things in the U.S. debate about this. One is, if you're thinking about replacement rates and who needs them, if you've covered 94% of the labor force, it's not clear that the people above that particularly need it. If you put in place a 12.4% pure tax, that's a whopping increase in taxes with all of the implications of that. And there is concern by some long-term supporters of Social Security that the continued viability of the program is dependent on the degree of progressivity in it. If you make it too progressive, it will undercut support. The proposal that the President has put forth for cutting benefits moves it almost to a flat benefit, and it is widely thought that that would undercut support. In the plan Peter Orszag and I developed, we put a 3% tax on earnings above the 90,000. We also boost the 90,000 a bit. That struck us as a politically plausible level of additional taxation, as well as one that we thought would not undercut the system. Medicare, our system of health insurance government provided for the elderly, is financed by a 2.9% earnings tax without limit. There certainly are people calling for exactly what you've said. I think with a president who has said he's adamant there will be absolutely no tax increases, it seems to me that what you are suggesting is not a political compromise.
Interested in your comments about contracting out, and I took it that you were saying no particular merit in having contracting out. Would you not accept that that contracting out creates diversification? Because it's all one rice bowl and it's all coming out of one economy, but there aren't, within contracting out, which is funded as against unfunded state pensions, do you not have different political risks, different economic risks, different market risks? Therefore, there is some merit in diversification from having some contracting out as well as pay-as-you-go state.
Okay. The couple of things to recognize in that. The first thing is that contracting out, because of the cash flow implications, creates a lot of political risk on the residual system. Secondly, contracting out, as done in the U.S., where Congress is setting the interest rate charged on the loan, would also create political risk for the accounts, because the gain of your earning more than you have to pay back is there. The third, in the U.S., as in the U.K., we rely a great deal on private pensions, at least for half of the labor force. Those private pensions overwhelmingly are defined contribution. Giving people another defined contribution substitute is lining up with their existing risk. It's not diversifying. It's shifting from risk that's correlated with one piece to risk that's correlated with another piece. And so I don't see the political risk argument coming in. And when you have a residual system, there are two kinds of political risk. One is the pure out-of-the-blue political risk. I don't take that very seriously. The right in the U.S. says tomorrow Congress could vote to stop paying all benefits. You know how many of those congressmen would get reelected if that happened. You know how much they like getting reelected. That's not a serious risk. The serious risk is something happens to either demography or economics, so that support of the system gets difficult. And the question is, how does that get spread around? If it gets spread around in a sensible way, a lot of lead time, phased in small changes spread over a wide population, that's not a political risk. That's a political hedge. That is what defined benefit pensions can do for risk spreading that defined contribution pensions simply cannot do. And if you look at the possibility that they'll come in abruptly, which is where it really is, or it'll be designed badly rather than well, then the thing to recognize is the residual program, as long as you have it, is being hit with these pay-as-you-go problems. And the fact that you've carved out a piece doesn't make the size of the problem disappear in the way the U.S. is talking about it. You still have the problem of financing the benefits minus what's financed by these loan paybacks. So if your cash flow drops, you're going to hit the remaining benefits about as badly as you would have hit all of the benefits, and it's going to have different distributional implications because you're going to be looking at only a part of the program rather than the whole program. You have shifted interest rate risk to these people, but I don't, you know, the fact that you have to respond to an interest rate risk, a DC system does it automatically, a DB system does it legislatively. Longer life expectancy, a DC system cuts your benefits automatically, a DB system does it phased in. I just do not see significant, I don't see the scenarios. I hear the words, and certainly they're said a lot in the U.S. debate. I don't see the scenarios where here is a model of the political process and here is the gain. And I look at the other elements, they're expensive. We have every expectation that a considerable majority of people don't know what they're doing, either in making the choice whether to contract out or not, and secondly, in picking a portfolio. I think it's facing real costs for sure for a maybe benefit that I find it very hard for anybody to identify and therefore quantify. Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Next, he'll be next. Go ahead. We've got time.
Okay. The 3% real return required on the borrowings from the government, why isn't that yield, say, benchmarked against the real yields on index stock issued by the government? Because it seems to me there's quite a large gap between the two if you look at current yields. In fact, the government could do rather well lending you that money and then asking you to invest back in government index-linked stock, and they'd make quite a good turn on the deal. Second sort of question is about the annuitization at retirement. Has the government really thought through the supply that would be available? Who's going to supply? What the sort of costs would be of those annuities? And will it mean they'll have to end up issuing lots of index-linked stock to the insurance companies in order to write the annuities?
The commission considered, without coming down, both the loan set at what was the projected long-term rate, because the Office of the Actuary thinks we're in temporary lower real interest rates, as I think is also the presumption here, or actually charging indexed rates on the loans, so that you could, in fact, buy government bonds and break even other than the 30 basis points anticipated charge, which is roughly half what Sweden and Chile are doing and considerably less than half of what is happening here. It seems to me, if they go down this route, it makes more sense to index it to the actual yields on actual bonds and take it from there. The government has not thought seriously about the annuitization issue. The National Academy of Social Insurance did appoint a panel that has looked into that. They issued a report in January. I haven't actually read it, but there is significant background material on how to do it, and there are two schools of thought. One school is the government just gets into the annuitization business, with the assets held to finance it invested privately and bid for with particular ways, but the government having the responsibility and the residual risk for doing it on the grounds that the insurance company risk premia are a cost which the government could avoid. Other people have recognized that if we're going to rely on private insurance companies to provide it, yes, the government's going to have to provide the appropriate assets to be backing. So that's right on target. There was a hand there. Yeah.
A series of related questions. The most important one, do you expect major Social Security reform being passed by the U.S. during
just
Bush's?
Because I have limited memory.
Okay.
Why don't I ask a question, I'll answer it.
Okay.
Ask your second question,
okay,
I'll answer it. Otherwise,
reform, I will forget. Reform passed during Bush's second term, and if so, what will it look like? First question.
I think the answer is no, there won't be reform. Let me give you a little U.S. political history. I'll start with 1972. Up till then, there was nothing automatically adjusted in the system. Congress, from time to time, voted changes in the tax rate, the tax cap, and the benefit formula. For a while, in the 60s, once inflation picked up, it became an annual event. For a while, Congress loved doing it because they could go home and say, we raised your benefits. But then they went home and people said, why didn't you raise my benefits more than you did? And suddenly it became an unattractive thing for Congress to do instead of attractive. So they asked for legislation that would automatically index, capturing what they had been doing. The trouble is what they had been doing, which may or may not have made sense on a one-off basis, didn't make sense on a continuing basis. The system was over-indexed, and in a wonderful moment in legislative history, the chief actuary, an almost brand new chief actuary, was testifying before, I believe, one of the Senate committees, and was asked, I have been told that the system is not properly indexed. Is that true? And he said, yes, it is true, but at the inflation rates that the U.S. has had historically, there is not a financial problem coming from that. 1972 was not a good time to rely on continued low inflation. The cost of the system skyrocketed. And in 1977, we got the current structure. The actuarial hole that I said is 1.9% of payroll right now, it was more than four times that in 1977. Congress could say there was a mistake made by those congressmen back in 1972, and we have to fix it. The 77 fix did not have much of a political difficulty because it was absolutely essential. But they didn't want to do any more than they had to, so they did something so that if the economy did well, they would just scrape through until those delayed effects kicked in, and then they'd be okay for a long time. Not a good time, 1977, to rely on the fact that there would not be a serious recession in the early 80s. So in 1983, the financial hole was about the same as it is now. But the system was due to run out of money in 2 months, not 35 years. That put a lot of heat on Congress. Even so, it was difficult to get agreement. The reason being, as I alluded to earlier, if you're cutting benefits and raising taxes, you don't want to stand alone doing that. You need cross-party consensus, in your term, a bipartisan agreement here. A deal was worked out between President Reagan, representing the Republicans, Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill from Massachusetts, representing the Democrats. The thing was shepherded through a commission headed by Alan Greenspan, not yet the world-famous star Alan Greenspan. And the Greenspan Commission, what was legislated was close to that, not quite all of it, and basically both parties agreed they wouldn't be attacking the other side. I think if we're going to get legislation, it would require that kind of agreement. The President has said there are two things he's absolutely adamant about. He must have these voluntary carve-out accounts, and he will not raise the tax rate. He used to say taxes, but he now says the tax rate. The Democrats are absolutely adamant they will not make a deal unless the voluntary individual accounts are off the table. Since they're afraid of bait and switch, they won't even talk about what they're in favor of until the President takes it off the table. And then they will, as happened in 83, push for doing a lot of what is at issue on the revenue side and not on the benefit cut side. So the president, I think, would have to give on his second point. I think if the president were willing to give, he could get a deal. I've never met the man, but I don't think he's willing to give, so I would be very surprised if we have any legislation. Radical change in the next election could change, next congressional election could change that. But my political forecast is nothing will happen.
Then a more technical question. You put a lot of emphasis on replacement ratios, but the replacement concept used by the Office of the Auditors is rather primitive. What replacement ratio do you find more attractive?
The trouble is this extraordinary diversity in earnings histories. And so what we're looking for is a system which, for people with some kinds of histories, makes sense as what U.S. Social Security has always been meant to be from the beginning, not enough to retire on comfortably, but a foundation for combining it with what we used to call the three-legged stool, employer-provided pensions, individual savings. Just as you don't know how big a foundation is, it's not clear it's worth worrying a whole lot about pulling down. Should we compare it to the last 10 years? Should we compare it to real or relative wages? I mean, you can wring out a whole lot of different ways of doing the calculation. There isn't one right one, because there are different right ones for different parts of the population. This, I think, is just meant to say, do we have a big system? Do we have a small system? Gee, for those one-third who are relying on this alone, how low do we want to make it? I think these numbers are adequately suggestive. When they produce a single example, it's somebody a bit higher up the income distribution than that $30,000, something around 36 now, as more closer to the median for more of the full-time people. But we're talking about differences here. There isn't a magic number anyway, so there's no point in deciding how you would measure it if it meant something, since we know this just kind of a sense. There are things that are just way too small. There are things that are so large that there's very little incentive to save on top of it. The U.S. would like to be somewhere in the middle of that, and I don't think there's a refinement we particularly need. There was a hand here that was up first.
One of the problems about annuitization in defined contribution plans is that the individual bears very large risks associated with the timing of retirement. and part of the problem in the UK with defined contributions have been that your retirement date can make a huge difference just because you retire on a week when the stock market is low and there are rules about immediate annuitization. How does the American system propose to handle that issue?
There are two contributing factors to the large swing in replacement rates that can happen in a very short time. One of them is what happens to your accumulation, and the other is what happens to the determinants of the price of an annuity. The president has proposed to address the former by having as a default that you would have to explicitly opt out of once you pass, I don't know, something like 50, what's called a life cycle account, where the fraction of the account in stocks would steadily shrink and you'd be heading towards zero. And so you'd have it mostly in real bonds, and that would take care of that part of the risk. It doesn't take care of the other part of the risk, and if you rely on private markets, that is a continuing problem. Obviously, if the government were to do the annuitization, it could do some smoothing.
You've shown us that. Sorry. Thanks very much. You've shown us that the U.S. Public pension system is to run into trouble in 2041. But I think in the majority of OECD countries, away from the Anglo-Saxon world, Netherlands, Sweden, and so on, the state pension system is very largely still pay-as-you-go. Can I ask whether you think this is a terrible problem or not? And if it is at least partly a problem, what principles determine how quickly we should adjust to a state system with a higher degree of funding?
You've put together two things which are not necessarily belonging together. When you have the baby boomers retiring is an issue connected with fertility. Fertility is more of a problem for an unfunded system than a funded system on the straight financial calculation. But these systems also all suffer from increasing life expectancy, and funding helps a little bit there because the interest rate's a little different, but it's the same problem in both of them. I think the issue is you can set up a totally unfunded system that has the kind of automatic adjustments happening early enough that you don't run into crises. Crises come when there's a need for sudden change. So the Swedish notional defined contribution system, topped up with their adjustment of the nominal interest rate that you earn on your notional accumulation, is something that you could set up that never has to have sharp changes, never runs out of money. They do it all on the benefit side. You could do it on a mix of benefit and taxes. The problem in France and Germany, and has been the problem in Italy, is that you have a system that does not include, the Italians voted it, but it's coming in way down the road, does not include the kind of automatic adjustments that keep you on track. It's a system that is large relative to retirement needs, so it's much harder to deal with than something that's only part of how you're going to finance yourself. And I think the problems there are problems where you need to make adjustments, and you need to make adjustments balancing the shock to soon to retire people against the government's ability to finance it without setting off financial problems. I don't think there is a magic trade-off there. We've got two bad problems which they've allowed themselves to be painted into a corner by waiting until the problem is imminent and having the problem very large. The point is, when you're at a point like that, funding that matters, funding that raises national savings, is an additional cost call on revenues. So if you say, as the Germans have said explicitly, we've got a very high tax rate, we don't want to raise it much beyond where we are, how are we going to deal with that? If you want to introduce funding, you got to be pushing up the tax rate. So unless you think pushing up the tax rate makes sense, funding is not part of the cure once you've painted yourself into that kind of corner. But I think these systems need adjustments, and they need to think how comfortable they are with induced changes, with what kind of lead times. President Bush took as his principle, nobody 55 or over should have the rules changed on them. There is talk about changing how we measure inflation, cost of living adjustments, which would obviously be a change in the rules. Beyond that, that's kind of been taken as the sort of lead time we think important. And we know while the debts are fairly large, the European countries aren't facing Argentina-like concerns about their ability to fund it. So I would hope it could be phased in terms of staying within pay-as-you-go and doing benefit cuts and perhaps down the road creating room for funding. But funding takes resources. If you're not willing to put up the resources, then you can't do funding.
Yeah, there's one on the up deck, I think.
Ah, I haven't been looking up. Thank you.
Professor Diamond, if you were advising the... Oh, thank you. If you were advising the Adair Turner at the Pensions Commission on the reform of pensions in the UK, what would you be, perhaps you are, what would you be...
No, I'm not.
...advising them to, what dangers would you be advising them to seek to avoid?
I've already touched on what I think would be the most important messages there. One is price indexing of benefits just makes no sense. I mean, it was it may be attractive as a cover for cutting benefits, but it doesn't make sense. The second thing is I think it's important to pay attention to both poverty alleviation and decrease in reliance on means-tested benefits so that people have savings incentives and have less personal distress associated with it, and also that replacement rates matter quite far up the income distribution. That's going to call for more resources than I think is currently going into it. As I'm sure everybody in the room knows, the share of GDP, current and projected for retirement benefits here is very low. I think there's lots of room to raise it to address both of these. I would hope to get good incentives for continued work. Nothing magical about 65. The incentives, the 10.4% is a good incentive, but they disappear. I think we've got to think about how to package them in a way that they start making more sense to people as incentives to delay the start, which for many people will mean continued to work. Obviously, somebody well off who thought it was a good deal could retire anyway and still delay. In a study in the U.S. looking at people who were fully retired before they turned 62, we found something on the order of 10% didn't claim benefits for a year, presumably so they get larger benefits once they started. That, I think, is useful because poverty is particularly among the oldest, and that includes widows. And indeed, I would like to see the concept of a survivor replacement rate, that is, the ratio of benefits received by a survivor to benefits that had been received by a couple, get the kind of attention that replacement rates at retirement gets in many countries. And I haven't looked at how survivor benefits are structured here. In many countries, including the U.S., they are too low, and in the U.S., they are also random relative to earnings histories in a way that nobody has made sense of. And then I would say if maybe there's a basis for contracting out because of what it does for the political process here. I obviously know nothing about the political process. I'd be a skeptic that it mattered. I would think the any contracting out option, if there's an obligation to keep it, should be cleaned up. I think thinking about the way President Bush has proposed doing it in the U.S. has a lot going for it. If this was happening in the U.S. and I was asked to design it, that's exactly how I would design it. And we had a lengthy debate among academics over issues of different ways of designing it and the implications. Have I left out? And I don't have a view of whether the state pension age at 65 should be pushed up or not. One would hope there would be some kind of study of what's happening to different groups right now around 64, 65, 66 as a basis for that. And I would certainly not think that there is a simple automatic indexing rule that would make sense. I think you've got to get into rather detailed studies of who's really affected. Because when you push that age back to allow larger benefits for people starting later, well, that option's there already. So you've got to ask, what's the benefit? You can't just say, well, you'll get a higher benefit. Yes, you get a higher benefit at the older age, but that doesn't answer the question. So I think that would be the one thing that really needs more study, as it does in the U.S.
Peter, I think it's probably an ideal note on which to wind up. It remains to me for me to thank Peter for an extremely informative lecture on a topic of great importance, and also to remind him that he'll be sitting next to Adair Turner at dinner, so he'll have every opportunity to, at least at that point, have an input into our policy process here in the UK. Thank you very much, Peter. Finally, I should mention you're all welcome to join us for a reception that will be held in the atrium right away. So for those of you at the LSE who know, just file out, and the others just follow the crowd, and you'll find your way